If a trauma patient comes in with a smashed midface and you just blindly insert a nasal breathing tube, you might actually push that tube directly through a fractured bone at the base of the skull and like right into their cranial vault. Welcome to the high-stakes reality of emergency airway management.
Yeah, it is a terrifying complication, and honestly, it perfectly illustrates why textbook theory just isn't enough when you're actually standing in the trauma bay. I mean, the clock is ticking the second that patient crosses the threshold. Before you even look at blood pressure or, you know, attempt to stop internal bleeding, you have to secure that single vital lifeline. It's the A in the ABCs of trauma and resuscitation for a very, very profound reason.
Right. And today's deep dive is custom tailored for you, you know, the medical student or the intern preparing for these exact unforgiving scenarios in the ED. We're unpacking a literal masterclass of clinical pearls created specifically for this module by your source, Dr. Jose A. Ribeiro, MD, FACP, FAAEM, a professor in emergency medicine.
Yeah, and Dr. Ribeiro's notes really strip away all that theoretical fluff. They focus entirely on the mechanics of what actually keeps a patient alive at like 2 in the morning. It takes you way beyond those idealized algorithms that you learn in the classroom.
Exactly. So we're going to explore the absolute fundamentals of basic airway management. We'll break down the critical difference between patency and protection, detail the physical maneuvers and adjuncts you need to master, dive into the mechanics of bag valve mask ventilation using the MANS mnemonic, and finally, look at why the pediatric airway completely changes all the rules. Let's jump in.
Sounds good.
So before you reach for any equipment or push medications, you have to accurately assess the patient's status. And Dr. Ribeiro makes it super clear that having an open airway is not the same thing as having a safe airway.
Right. Conflating those two things is a massive trap that catches a lot of new clinicians. I mean, patency and protection are fundamentally different concepts. Patency is purely mechanical. It just describes the physical anatomic pathway that air must travel from the mouth and nose down into the lungs. So if there's a failure of patency, you're looking at a physical roadblock. You could be dealing with a severe facial fracture, crushing the nasal passage, or a choking hazard, or even severe angioedema where the tongue and the pharynx swell up and clamp the tube shut.
Yeah. Okay, so if I walk up to the stretcher and ask the patient their name, they answer me clearly, their airway is currently patent.
Right.
Because phonation requires air to move unobstructed past the vocal cords.
Exactly. Phonation proves patency in that exact second. But it guarantees absolutely nothing about protection. Because protection is a higher order issue. It's entirely about neurological control.
Right. The way I like to look at it is an analogy. I compare patency to a cleared highway. Like there's no debris on the road, no physical blockage.
Yeah.
But protection is having a vigilant traffic cop on duty at the intersection. You know, the highway might be completely clear, but without the cop, meaning the brain's reflexes directing traffic, a catastrophic crash is basically inevitable.
That's a perfect way to picture it. And in this clinical scenario, the quote-unquote crash is a massive aspiration event. A patient with, say, a severe traumatic brain injury, profound hemorrhagic shock, or active seizures might have a beautifully clear anatomic pathway.
Right, the highway is open.
Exactly. But their altered mental status means they've lost their gag reflex. They can't swallow effectively or cough, so they cannot stop pooling blood or saliva or vomit from sliding right down that clear highway and flooding their lungs.
It's terrifying. And the sources provide a definitive rule for assessing whether that neurological traffic cop is actually on duty. It's based on the Glasgow Coma Scale, right? The clinical pearl here is less than 8. Intubate.
Yeah, that's the golden rule. If a patient's GCS drops to 8 or lower, their neurological reflexes are effectively offline. They just cannot reliably protect themselves from silent aspiration. You have to step in and secure the airway for them with an endotracheal tube.
Now, going back to the physical roadblock side of things, conditions like anaphylaxis or maybe a thermal burn to the airway from inhaling smoke. How quickly can a patent airway become unprotected in conditions like angioedema? Like, if I hear them speaking, but their voice is a little hoarse, how much time do I actually have?
You might only have minutes,
yeah.
Truly. Swelling in the soft tissues of the pharynx progresses exponentially, not linearly.
Wow.
Exponentially.
Yeah, the edema pushes against the loose connective tissue in the airway. And once that inflammatory process really accelerates, a patient talking to you with just a slightly hoarse voice can have their airway swell completely shut before you can even drop the medications.
Look, that's incredibly fast.
It is. You have to act before the airway is lost, because waiting until they actually can't breathe forces you into a chaotic, bloody surgical airway situation where you were literally cutting into the neck.
Yeah.
Right? Nobody wants that.
Yeah.
So once you've identified that the airway is compromised, whether their GCS just dropped to a 6 or their tongue is starting to swell, your immediate response isn't always reaching for a breathing tube. The tech says your first interventions are entirely physical. You have to use your hands and basic tools to prop that highway open.
Right, because the most common cause of airway obstruction in an unconscious patient isn't like a piece of steak or a foreign body. It's actually their own anatomy.
Really?
Yeah, when the musculature relaxes, gravity just takes over. The base of the tongue falls backward and rests really heavily against the posterior pharynx, which cuts off the airflow completely.
Okay, and Dr. Ribeiro details two manual maneuvers to fix this: the head tilt chin lift and the jaw thrust. Now, the head tilt chin lift makes physical sense. You push down on the forehead to tilt the head back and lift the chin upward. It mechanically lifts the tongue off the back of the throat. But there is a massive warning label on this one. You can never use it if there is any suspicion of a cervical spine injury, right?
Never. Because tilting the head back forces the cervical spine into extension. If the patient has an unstable fracture from, you know, a car crash or a fall, extending that neck could sever the spinal cord. You could easily turn a treatable temporary injury into permanent paralysis.
Oh, man. So for trauma patients, you have to use the jaw thrust.
Mandatory. For the jaw thrust, you place your fingers behind the angles of the mandible on both sides of the face and physically push the jaw anteriorly.
Just pushing it straight forward.
Exactly. Because the tongue is attached to the mandible, pushing the jaw forward pulls the tongue base away from the airway while keeping the C-spine perfectly neutral.
Right. But here's the problem. The jaw thrust works beautifully. But now your hands are pinned to the patient's face holding that position. You can't reach for medications, you can't grab the suction, and you definitely can't grab the bag valve mask. You need a way to free up your hands.
And that is exactly where airway adjuncts come into play. Specifically, the oropharyngeal airway, the OPA, and the nasopharyngeal airway, the NPA.
Okay, so the OPA is that curved, rigid plastic hook, right? You put it in the mouth and it sits right over the curve of the tongue to hold it forward. But patient selection is super critical here.
Very critical. You can only use an OPA in a deeply unconscious patient who has absolutely zero gag reflex. If you insert a rigid plastic hook into the throat of someone who is even a little bit conscious, they will violently gag and vomit.
Which creates that massive aspiration risk we just talked about.
Yeah.
But I did see in Dr. Ribeiro's notes that the OPA has a really cool second life. It doubles as a bite block for intubated patients, so they don't bite down and sever the breathing tube.
Yeah, it's an excellent dual-purpose tool. But like you said, for those semi-conscious patients who still have a gag reflex, you have to pivot to the nasopharyngeal airway, or NPA. This is a soft, flexible tube placed right through the nose that just bypasses the tongue entirely.
Right. And this brings us right back to that terrifying scenario from the intro. You can use an NPA on a semi-conscious patient, but Dr. Ribeiro says you absolutely must avoid it if there is central facial trauma. Can you vividly explain why that is so dangerous?
Oh, it's nightmare fuel. So severe mid-face trauma often involves a fracture of the cribriform plate. That's the very thin, porous bone at the roof of the nasal cavity separating the nasal passage from the brain.
Okay.
If a patient has a shattered cribriform plate and you blindly push a semi-rigid NPA tube into a traumatized nasal passage, it can bypass the pharynx entirely. It will slide right through that fractured bone and lodge directly inside the cranial vault.
Into their brain.
Literally into their brain. Mm. So if you see raccoon eyes, a smashed nose, or you feel instability in those mid-face bones, the nasal route is completely off limits.
Wow. You just stick to the mouth and rely on a jaw thrust until you can intubate.
Exactly. You eliminate the risk of a catastrophic iatrogenic brain injury.
Okay, so let's say you've propped the highway open. The pathway is clear. But what if the patient still isn't breathing adequately, their apneic, or taking those ineffective agonal gasps? You have to breathe for them. And this requires mastering the bag valve mask, or BVM.
Right, and BVM ventilation is arguably the single most important manual skill in emergency medicine. If you can effectively bag a patient, they won't die from hypoxia while you prepare for intubation. But there are strict rules. You only use a BVM for apneic or agonal patients. You never try to bag a spontaneously breathing patient.
Because that actually worsens their hypoxia, right?
Yeah.
You end up fighting their natural respiratory cycle.
Exactly. Pushing positive pressure air into their lungs while they are actively trying to exhale creates massive airway pressures and fails to deliver oxygen.
And even when bagging an apneic patient, the technique sounds pretty difficult under pressure. The target is just one breath every 5 to 6 seconds. So that's roughly 10 to 12 breaths a minute. with a tidal volume of just 5 to 6 cc per kilogram. You only squeeze until you see the chest rise.
Right. And in a high adrenaline code, your instinct is to squeeze that bag as fast and hard as you can.
Right. You want to help them.
But overventilation is a massive pitfall. If you squeeze too hard or too fast, the pressure of the air overcomes the anatomical resistance of the lower esophageal sphincter. So instead of expanding the lungs, the air shoots down the esophagus and fills the stomach.
Gastric insufflation, which means their stomach balloons up with air, massively increasing the risk of vomiting.
Yes. And a distended stomach physically pushes up against the diaphragm, which compresses the lung bases and makes it even harder for you to ventilate them.
So to avoid that, you need a perfect mask seal. The sources describe the single-handed CE grip. You form a C with your thumb and index finger around the mask and use the other three fingers, the E, to hook under the jaw and lift it up. But honestly, maintaining that grip with one hand sounds incredibly fatiguing.
It is. The grip eventually slips, air leaks out, and oxygen saturations drop. That's why the two-person BVM technique is the gold standard. One provider uses both hands to maintain a flawless mask seal and a strong jaw thrust, while the second provider just focuses on delivering a slow, smooth squeeze of the bag.
Dividing the workload. But even with two people, it can still be nearly impossible to bag some patients. Dr. Rubero provides the Mill-Upwane-S mnemonic to predict difficult BVM ventilation. Let's break that down.
Yeah.
M stands for mask seal issues, right? Like trauma, blood, or beards.
Exactly. If there's thick facial hair or severe trauma, the plastic mask just can't sit flush against the skin. The air just escapes through the gaps.
Makes sense. And O is for obesity.
Right. With profound obesity, you have a massive amount of weight resting on the chest wall and anterior neck. You have to use significantly higher pressures to lift that heavy chest, which increases the risk of forcing air into the stomach.
Got it. A is age over 55. That's about the loss of tissue elasticity, making the upper airway prone to collapsing.
Exactly.
Now, I want to push back a little on the N, which stands for no teeth or being edentulous. There is a fascinating, almost counterintuitive clinical pearl here. Normally, you clear absolutely everything out of the mouth before intubation. But Dr. Rubero advises that if an edentulous patient wears dentures, you should actually leave the dentures in during BVM ventilation. Can you explain the mechanics of how that works?
Yeah, it's brilliant. Think about the architectural scaffolding of the human face. Your teeth and jawbone provide the structural support for your cheeks and lips. When a patient has no teeth, their cheeks sink in, right? The structural integrity of the lower face basically collapses.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Right. If you press a rigid plastic mask over sunken, collapsed cheeks, you cannot establish an airtight seal. Air just leaks out the sides. By leaving the dentures in place, you instantly restore that facial scaffolding. The mask now has a firm surface to seal against. You only pull the dentures out right before you pass the laryngoscope to intubate.
That is such a clever mechanical trick. And finally, the S in MOAS stands for stiff lungs or stiff neck.
Yeah, stiff lungs, like in severe asthma or ARDS, resist the air. High resistance means squeezing harder, which again forces air down the path of least resistance into the stomach.
Okay, so you've mastered the adult rules. But in emergency medicine, the patient rolling through the door might not be a 55-year-old adult. It might be a 2-year-old child. And the text makes it clear that you have to immediately shift gears. Kids are not small adults.
Not at all. Anatomically and physiologically, infants and children demand an entirely different playbook. The pediatric airway is honestly a minefield of hidden anatomical traps.
Right. Starting from the outside, children have a prominent occiput. The back of their head is disproportionately large. So if you lay a toddler flat on a stretcher, their neck flexes forward and closes the airway.
Right. Their chin basically gets forced down onto their chest. To correct this, you must place a small towel roll under their shoulders, not their head, to get them into a neutral position.
And looking inside, it's even trickier. They have a larger tongue, larger adenoids, and this flappy, omega-shaped epiglottis. Plus, their larynx sits much higher, more anteriorly, around C3, C4, compared to an adult's.
Yeah, which means when you put a laryngoscope in a pediatric patient, you have to physically pull the blade much higher and further forward to even see the vocal cords.
Now, regarding equipment, Dr. Rubero gives a formula for uncuffed endotracheal tubes, age divided by 4 plus 4. But wait, why are we using uncuffed tubes? In adults, we always inflate a balloon cuff to seal the airway.
That is the most crucial anatomical difference. In adults, the airway is cylindrical. The narrowest part is at the vocal cords. But in children, the airway is funnel-shaped. The narrowest part is actually below the cords at the cricoid ring.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Because the cricoid ring is naturally so narrow, it essentially acts as a physiological cuff around the tube. You don't always need an artificial balloon in young kids because their anatomy creates the seal.
That makes a ton of sense. The cricoid ring is the cuff. Now, on the physiological side, I noticed something about the pediatric chest wall. The sources say a child's chest wall is highly compliant, meaning flexible. I read that and thought, well, a flexible chest sounds like it would make breathing easier. Can you clarify why this is actually a dangerous physiological trap?
It completely sounds like a good thing, but it's deadly. In an adult, the ribs are angled downward like a bucket handle. When you inhale, muscles pull the ribs up and out, expanding the chest and creating a pump to draw air in. But a child's ribs are already sitting horizontally.
So they can't swing up to create more volume.
Exactly. Furthermore, because that chest wall is so soft and compliant, when a kid tries to take a deep breath against an airway obstruction like in croup, the chest wall simply caves inward under the negative pressure.
Oh, wow. So you see those severe retractions around the ribs. The flexible chest isn't helping pull air in. It's just collapsing.
Exactly. Which forces the child to rely almost entirely on their diaphragm to breathe. And the diaphragm is just a muscle. It can only work at maximum capacity for so long. And kids already have massive metabolic demands and very low functional residual capacity. They burn through their oxygen reserves incredibly fast.
So when their diaphragm fatigues, they don't just slowly tire out?
No, they fall off a physiological cliff. They go from compensating to complete respiratory failure and cardiac arrest in minutes. You cannot be lulled into a false sense of security just because they currently look like they're moving air. You have to use the pediatric assessment triangle appearance, work of breathing, circulation, and intervene long before that diaphragm gives out.
We've covered incredible ground today. We established the vital difference between a patent highway and a protected airway, covered why the jaw thrust is mandatory in trauma, and why a shattered cribriform plate means abandoning the nasal route.
And we unpack the Monet's mnemonic, the dangers of gastric insufflation, and all those anatomical and physiological traps hidden in the pediatric airway.
For you, as an intern or medical student, these aren't just textbook facts. These are the immediate, hands-on interventions that will actually save your patient's life before a definitive airway is surgically established. Mastering these basics separates a prepared clinician from a panicked one.
Absolutely.
We've spent all this time talking about how to physically manage the patient's anatomy. But here's a thought to take with you on your next shift. Consider the cognitive airway management you have to perform on yourself. In the chaos of a trauma bay, with alarms blaring and a pediatric patient rapidly desaturating, how do you manage your own physiological stress response? How do you regulate your own breathing and heart rate so that your mind stays sharp and your hands remain perfectly steady when you hold that BVM?